Welcome back, everyone, to episode 9 of the Dotcast. I'm very pleased to say today we have an absolute corker for you. It's another special, and the subject is auctions. As always, I was joined by my fellow co-host, Matt Howes. And in this episode, we wanted to really discuss and explore an integral part of the automotive industries. Now, some say, obviously, auctions, it's where it all starts. It starts with the vehicle. Now, to do this, we thought it would be worthwhile to get someone along who lives and breathes auction, who has got plenty of experience in this subject, and we were very, very lucky enough to sit down with our special guest. Our special guest has got over 30 years' experience in the automotive industry. They've worked as a sales manager, dealer principal, operations manager for some of the biggest franchise groups in the UK. He also worked as a retail and consumer specialist for Black Book, and in his current role as insight and strategy director for Cox Automotive. He shares plenty of industry expertise across various different podcasts, updates, so please do have a look out for him on LinkedIn. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Sit back, relax, grab a cup of tea, and do enjoy. Today's special guest is Philip Northard.
Good morning. How are you? Are you both? Are you okay?
Good, you?
Well. Yeah, good. Good.
So welcome, Philip. Thanks for taking the time out, coming down to come on the Dotcast. Obviously, we want to talk auctions. But before we jump into the subject of auctions, I think it'd be good for us and the listeners to kind of get a little bit of an idea about yourself.
Yeah, you don't want to hear about me 30 odd. We'll stick at 30 plus.
Yes. 30 plus years 30, in the industry.
30 but plus years.
It's a funny one, and most people do normally laugh. But you know, when you say to someone, how did you get into the automotive industry? People don't normally go, I chose to, they went into it. But
no, I'll tell you exactly. I mean, I was 17 year old. I had a partner at the time, and her sister's boyfriend or something was in the industry. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and he said, have a crack at this. And that was kind of it. I got my £2,000 basic salary, a company car, my blazer and tie at the time, and that was kind of it. And yeah, learned very quickly the game of car sales in the real world.
Yeah.
Back in the day, should we say.
Was this franchise or was this a...
It was a franchise, yeah. My first sale was an 88E Fiat Panda.
Nice.
To a couple of nurses around Manchester area, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a longer story than that around that, which I won't go into because it's quite a long one, that it didn't get insured, it didn't get taxed, and they ended up coming back a while later and taking away a G-plate Panda when it should have been an 88E
right.
Panda, because they didn't turn up, everyone couldn't get hold of them again.
But, what a long story. Panda.
Fiat Panda, and I had to sit there in the hottest day of my life in the back of this Fiat Panda,
yeah,
with these customers, keeping my blazer on and my shirt and tie entirely done, sweating away for about 2 hours on a test drive, thinking, I'm going to make a sale.
My
colleagues were back at the dealership watching some cup final or something on TV, I think it was, on a Saturday. So
yeah,
I learned very quickly.
Yeah. So, you know, you've done sales at various different levels within, in and around dealer, franchise dealerships. Then you went into a retail and consumer specialist for Black Book. Tell us, what was that
yeah,
like?
Yeah, so... Jaggy career all the way through, from trainee salesperson to regional director of franchise through supermarkets, independents, various different businesses, and then found my way into part of the editorial team at Cap HPI as it is now, which was Black Book back in Cap Black Book then, as the sort of the retail editor there. There for about 10 years with the editorial team, which gave me a kind of a way out of the car world, but into from the sales world onto the other side of the fence, which was always quite interesting because you were looking at it from a different side then.
Yeah.
But it was kind of good perspective because it gave me the opportunity then to look at from a market perspective of what's happening in the trade, as it is a wholesale and the auction world, and then obviously in terms of what's happening in the retail space, so what those vehicles go up for sale for, what incentives are coming through from the OEMs, because as you know, you can look at the wholesale data, but actually you need to understand what's happening in the new vehicle world with deposit contributions.
Yeah, what's going on the forecourt.
What's happening there on the forecourt to give you a real perspective of, as to what's happening at trade, which it gave me a good perspective there.
Yeah. No. And then was your next role then with Cox?
Into Cox Automotive.
Yeah.
So I joined them as an insight director 6 years ago now. It's there and thereabouts. So yeah, it's kind of role there is to understand our market, understand our industry, represent the business in all the trade associations, chair of the Vehicle Remarketing Association and other trade associations, and actually try and contextualise what's happening in the world of automotive.
Which is difficult at times.
It's yeah. more difficult, but I'm sure we'll get onto that later, won't we? But you're trying to contextualise what's happening,
yeah.
but more importantly, what does that mean for our customers? What does that mean for
yeah.
retailers, lenders, remarketers, etc., including you know our business?
Yeah, yeah. No, super interesting part. So, as we said from the start, auctions is the conversation today. Yeah. Prickly, I think about auctions. So I live about 20 minutes from Blackbush.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. obviously I've driven past it a million times. You know, used to work out on the, you know, on the field speaking to retailers. Auction conversations would come up on a real regular basis. Everyone knows what happened. We had COVID, right? But what's your thoughts on how COVID changed the landscape for how retailers brought or still do buy trade vehicles?
Yeah, it's an interesting one really, because the pre-COVID, there was always this view that the auction world would move more into the digital virtual space.
Yeah.
As with everything else, it you know become more automated, more virtual.
Yeah.
And whether that is, you know, in relation to the retailers as well, you know, this online buying, this click and collect, click and deliver environment in the dealer world.
Yeah.
That was always on the vision of the trend and the direction for the automotive sector, but clearly COVID accelerated that trend.
With most retail, really, isn't
it? As
it
did with retail yeah. and to a degree within auctions, because the auctions, you know, on that day back in 2020, March the 23rd, when you know the announcement came out and that was it.
Mm.
You know, everyone, what do we do? How do we manage this? And you know, be it retailer or auction centre, you had to go fully, you know, either close down initially and then work out how you're going to do this in a virtual space without any interaction in yeah. person. So that kind of moved very quickly into that space. Now, to a degree, it was always a strategic direction that we thought it would go that way, but the percentages of pure online buyers were low pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
COVID accelerated that, you know, for a period of time through the whole pandemic with the lockdowns and things like this. You know, it kind of remained online because you were doing the right thing in terms of protecting your colleagues as well as protecting the customers through those lockdowns. But then you kind of say, okay, so whereas an auction centre, it would be, you'd find out where the vehicles were, you'd make a decision as to which auction centre you were going to go based on your location and the product available.
Mm.
You'd then go to that site and you'd go and look at the vehicle to then intend to purchase through bidding. COVID then changed a little bit of that, because suddenly people realised that actually I can access various auctions throughout the UK. I can bid on numerous cars and I don't need to leave my office. I can access various auctions.
Effective use of time, isn't it?
And it kind of then created this use of time. And from a vendor perspective, suddenly their audience expanded. And there's a negative to that to a degree, because don't forget, some of the vendors have a very loyal customer base at an auction centre. One, because of locality, two, because of the, you know, the regular sale dates,
yeah.
everything else. So they get a lot of following. So there was a bit of pushback that actually, well, I'm not getting, they're not buying 25 cars off me to sell now, because he's not at that physical location locked in to buy my cars. He's sat at home
with much more choice.
With much more choice
yeah.
to a various of different sales.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, might still buy the 25 cars on that week, but it'll be from various locations.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of a counter effect that actually, what you've lost with that customer, you've gained with other customers that are now accessing your sale from different locations that wouldn't normally have got to your sale.
So
it kind of works out, and we've gone through that as a sector for a period of time now in terms of that physical versus virtual. It's interesting that, you know, we as a business have decided to go back physical through a large number of our locations. That was predominantly through demand of both the vendors and buyers.
Yeah.
But also with the market shift in terms of profile of stock and the way the market has moved in terms of age and mileage profiles of product that are now going through.
So that older vehicle, people want to touch and feel it, right?
It is a bit of that, you know, depending on who's listening to this, but you kind of, you know, the auction centres, it's not just the buying of a car, you know, there's the networking, there's the understanding of what's happening in the market, there's, you know, getting together. And actually, you go to an auction, you might go on the intention to buy certain vehicles, but actually when you get there, you're walking around, you'll see a different car, you think, actually, that's quite nice, I didn't see that online, or I didn't see that on the catalogue initially, or somebody will say to you, well, have you had a look at that one?
Yeah.
That looks like a nice car, it's got a good history. I don't think there's many buyers looking at it. So there's a bit of that goes on in the physical environment.
Yeah.
And if you think about the auctioneers, and, you know, I've never been an auctioneer, I've kind of been asked to go in it a few times and never done it. I'm trying to death, and I don't, people think the way I can speak and the speed I can speak, I probably do, but it's still frightens the death out of me. But I know some very good auctioneers. But being a pure online, and if we look through the pandemic, you know, suddenly these auctioneers have been taken from the rostrum in a hall with hundreds of people, either online and physically there, with the buzz, with the atmosphere, everything around them, bouncing off that atmosphere. You normally have on a 200 or 300 car sale, two auctioneers, so they'll switch between them to give each other a rest and do that, and they'll be bouncing off each other and having a bit of a laugh. But reality is they can read the room.
Yeah.
They can see whether that car's a little bit tough. Or
they'll know people as well, right? And they'll go and know
people, and they know what you're doing, and they'll pull people into it, and they can read the room a little bit, and they can keep, if they know that the car's getting a little bit of interest, they can keep it there in the hall, and they can hold on it a little bit longer and get the best price for the vendor.
Yeah.
A little bit more difficult in the virtual space, because you're
just seeing bids coming in.
Sat on a screen, bids coming in.
Yeah.
There's an element that you are time constrained, because, you know, there's a finite period of time you need to get through those 200 or 300 cars. So it's kind of, once that reserve's met, bidding starts to slow down. You don't know whether there's still people there actively thinking about buying it.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of move on, and you go on to the next sale, the next sale, the next sale. And you lose that in the virtual space. But there is a place for both. I mean, you know, we use the word phidgetal, which is I don't know who came up with that. I won't put my name to that one. Not very inventive. But, you know, you need the both. Because you need
to give the option, don't you?
You need to give the option. You need to give the flexibility both to the vendors that want a pure virtual sale because it's more efficient for them. The buyers give that flexibility. Because you do get buyers sat in the physical auction centre.
That's my point I was just going to raise.
Online bidding online as well. They're catching up with friends. They're having a coffee. They're checking at what's at their local one within a reasonable distance on the main stock that they're looking at buying.
Yeah.
But they're also seeing two or three cars that are going on at another sale somewhere else at a different location that they're having a bid on anyway.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have to do one or the other. It is a blend of both. And, you know, they get that buzz, and you know, I think there's an element for both. And to your point before, Craig, that, you know, we lost 42 million vehicles out of production globally out of the 3 years.
Yeah.
UK lost in excess of 2.5 million new car registrations.
Mm-hmm.
That has a direct impact on 0-12, 0-24, 0-36 months. Yeah. Now in that 36-month period, we're going into the 0-48 month next year. And we already know that through the pandemic, retailers struggled getting stock.
Yeah.
A lot of them diversified into alternative brands if they were just focused on certain brands. they also went into all the higher mileage product.
Yeah.
And at the same time, so that sort of constrained product coming into the auction centres because retailers were keeping all the high mileage product for themselves for retail.
Yeah.
But also you had leasing extensions. So your average age of a multi-ability car went from 3 years to 4 year old.
Mm. Yeah.
And your leasing contracts went 6 month and 12 month extensions. So suddenly those 50,000 mile, 60,000 mile, 3 year old fleet cars that were coming back into the auction was now 4 year old, 70,000 mile vehicles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Older, higher mileage. And the retailers still want to see those grade threes, grade fours that need the work or that they want to listen to the engine, they just want to check the smoke coming out of it, they want to touch and feel it. So there's an element that the market dynamics of stock profile has also driven that desirability for that physical. You know, it's a 12-month-old ex-manufacturer cars, sub 10,000 miles.
Trust a bit more, can't you?
You know what? You've got to kick back because a lot of those are on approved deals anyway. Mm-hmm. The manufacturer,
yeah,
as a franchise dealer, that you have to buy so many cars, you have to go to a closed auction sale, you know, where that's Citroen, BM or whoever. You know, that's not much of an issue. But the older stuff is the bit that the buyers, the dealer network feel that they still need to go and touch and feel and see those cars.
Philip, you mentioned obviously around that dealer going to the physically the block would buy 25 from one location. The power of online, they obviously diversify in their commitment. Do you think that the buying online v buying at the block has affected the trade prices at all by comparison?
We're not really seeing it. I mean, we keep analysing it and you know, he's trying to, we look at it in terms of the data and go, okay, you know, what is, because our customers will ask, you know, the vendors and the D-Fleet people ask, you know, am I better off physically?
Can I get more online?
Can I get more online or can I get more physically?
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever got to an answer on that.
Is it because there's no type of sales?
There's no, you know, the type of vehicles, it's very difficult to compare.
Sure.
You have different sales on different days, different market dynamics. You know, when you look at something like dealer auction versus auction like Mannheim, the physical auction, you do get a variance in cap performance. But part of that is because you've got a variance in buyer fees.
Yes.
So the buyer fees play an element as well. And there's an element of risk and things like this. You know, you're buying... In the dealer auction world, you're buying trade to trade. You trust in that deal, you're buying it off, and if it's not right, you don't hand over the money.
Yeah.
In the auction world, you know, you bid on that car, you've got your guarantees, you pay your buyer's fee, and you get the car delivered. You know, so it's very difficult to judge where the performance is.
Yeah.
But we do continually try and analyze it. Because
you think as well, like, so someone who's got an online setup. You know, they're in their office, various different auctions online. They have to pay a premium to do that as well, don't they? Instead versus your buyer's fees when you're just physically down there. That person on the computer has to pay an additional fee for doing it in that format as well, right?
Yeah.
So it's, do they go, well, I'm not going to pay as much for a vehicle because I know I'm doing this. It's just an interesting theory behind it. But
it's whether I suppose the question is whether they... You know, would they hold back on how much they would pay for a vehicle?
Exactly.
On the potential risk of something they've not managed to to see. I mean, you know, appraisals, you know, you mentioned we might, you know, talk about AI and we'll probably get onto that, but you know, appraisals and imagery and everything else, you know, it's that good now and guarantees if the car's not right, do you know what, it'll be coming back. So there's probably enough guarantees in terms of that vehicle for the buyer that there is enough to push the car back if it's not right.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we were going to explore a little bit later on, I think, because I think that's interesting around auction. So if we're talking about what's flushing through the auctions at the moment, two particular subjects, actually, or two vehicle types. Firstly, LCV. Going for auction. How's that looking at the moment?
Very good.
Yeah.
I mean, again, try not to talk about us too much, but the only reference is that, you know, we've now just opened another LCV commercial centre up in Scotland to support that demand.
Good.
You know, commercial vehicles is hot property. And, you know, we know that we saw a massive acceleration through the pandemic with the Amazon, the home delivery demand, people going into self-employment.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, we saw that huge. Mm. I mean, you know, we talk about the bubble in used car vehicles, cars, but actually, you know, people forget to talk about the bubble that happened in commercial vehicles. I mean, it was just went mad. And that was import, you know, we were exporting products out to Europe as well. You know, there was stuff going out to Europe all the way through that. So, but I think, again, you know, you talk about physical versus virtual.
Yeah.
That van market, you know, you got your van bikes.
Yeah, different type of bike.
And I don't want to broad brush in terms of old school.
Yeah.
But your van is very unique.
Yeah.
You know, it's more unique than a car.
And it's a necessity, not a luxury.
It's a necessity, it's not a luxury.
Wait, we did talk a bit about that in a previous podcast.
There is a question about that.
There is customs
and everything else. And people
it's a bit of a fashion thing now, isn't it?
And multi-use and all this lot that go on. But I think, you know, the ply lined and the tipper market and all this lot, it's very unique. And, you know, you can look at the outside of a tipper and it look okay, the history look okay, but... You know, if there's some mechanical issue with the tipper element of it, you've got a serious cost problem coming. You know, there is a high demand for physical with that, but you know, we do very well in the virtual space with vans as well, because again, to your point, Matthew, that doesn't really matter as much because it's to serve a purpose, it's to do a job. You know, so they can buy that, they know exactly what they're going to get. It's not grade one. You know, it doesn't need to be out of the box. They know it's being used for BT or whoever, and it's, as long as it's right and it's what, and it's got the right curb weight, it's got the ply line, it's got this, it's got that,
it's got the correct Euro engine in it.
It's got the correct Euro engine, five or six, it ticks a box. It'll do its money and it'll do a job for the end user.
A quick one on that, actually. Is grading done differently for LCV? Or is it similar?
Has to be more difficult.
Yeah, because sure.
It's similar, but it's more difficult. Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert less. On it, but in one way there's less, but there's other things that you need to be looking at.
Yeah.
And that's before we even talk about EVs. You know, that's a whole different game as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think... Commercial vehicles, I mean, we have a very strong commercial team, and you know, I don't possess to be a commercial person. I mean, you know, you speak to, they know the products inside out, everything about it. They know gear ratios, curb weights, you name it, because it's hugely unique. You know, we talk about, through my years in the retail market, you know, you many times say, oh, I might start doing commercial vehicle, and you go, really? You just want to, you think there's an opportunity in commercial vehicles. They want, we'll start to stock some commercial vehicles. Okay, and who's going to sell them? Well, we'll just put them on the forecourt and we'll sell them. No. You need to know, you need to have somebody in there. You need to know what you're buying and you need to know what you're selling and you need to know how to talk to a commercial buyer, customer. If you start going down the process like you do in, you know, with a car sale, it ain't going to work.
Six-step sales process.
It ain't going to work. You know, because that commercial vehicle buyer, to the point earlier, it's to do a job.
Yeah.
They want to know if it's got this.
They're loyal as well to brand and model type.
They are to a degree. I mean, they know what they want. They know what works for them. They've got the people that can repair it. Mm-hmm. They know how to access the parts and the maintenance and everything else. So they kind of tend to stick to whatever that is, whether it's Ford or Iveco or whatever brand that is. But yeah, it's always quite a loyal base.
Yeah. And then moving on, in terms of, you touched on it there, and the EV piece. So Auto Trader recently relayed, in terms of independent sector, only 16% of independents stock a used EV in the forecourt for undoubtedly a multitude of reasons. Sort of to transition that into the auction world, but what are your thoughts on what, if any, trends are you seeing in terms of the EVs in the auction space?
I'd like to say we're seeing some signs of stabilisation, but that might paint the wrong image of what's going on. So
yeah, you're not going to put your name and say everything's all right.
Everything's okay, don't worry about it. EVs have stopped volatility in their RVs now, but we are starting to get a lot more people now entering the EV space. You know, the things like the ULEZ zone down in London, you know, they understand that that's going to expand out of London to other markets, or, you know, whether it, you know, okay, it's not just for the Euro 6 and things like this, but there is an appetite there. And when you start to look at some of the vehicles, when, you know, when we look at, if you look at Tesla, let's talk about Tesla. You look at what happened with Tesla back in October of last year. You know, it's
Elon drops the bomb out, doesn't
it? And he continued does, and he will continue to do so.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the, in context to that, you know, Tesla, if you look back into sort of 21 and 2022, and you look at new car registration figures, 2021, the Tesla 3 was the highest registered vehicle in a September month.
Yeah.
Because it had product. Okay. It was going into the fleet market. There was the benefit in kind, the opt-out and everything else. The fleet operators were transitioning to be an EV fleet operator, and the product was there and it was available. And it was, you know, on a contract, it was reasonably okay. It was acceptable. You know, you had companies that were 100% EV and you had a Tesla. So, but to a degree, those things were always going to go out, and to a degree, they were always going to come back.
Mm.
And they started coming back in volumes into a used vehicle market that wasn't ready.
Mm.
And there's an argument to say that some of the initial residual values may have been set optimistically to what the used vehicle market demand may be.
An unknown, though, wasn't it, really?
It was unknown.
Yeah.
And other peer manufacturers would have been setting their residual values against the same and everything else. So you had these vehicles coming back. So since October of last year, you know, we saw all the headlines where they were dropping 10% this month and 8% that month, etc. But suddenly, you know, sort of 6 months on, you start to look and go, hang on, I can buy a used Tesla now, 3 year old, for £20,000 to £25,000 at trade.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's a reasonable proposition. It's a 350 mile range EV. It's the kit to have. You know, in terms of the aspirational, the Tesla, you know, it suddenly that then comes within that £25,000 bracket.
Yeah,
it changes the market.
Yeah,
far more affordable to.
It's
to more
affordable and everything else. So there's a, you know, we're not finished yet. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, that you know, we are seeing a bit of stabilisation. Like the I-Pace had seen some severe pain.
Yeah.
On the back of what had been happening with Tesla and other products, but then it started to increase. I think this week JLR have just started to put out 0% and extended approved warranties on their I-Paces now to stabilise that used demand through their dealer network. So there's a lot being done, but I think, you know, I'm not the only one to say it. There's still a lot to be done around that used vehicle EV market. You know, they made the point that independent dealers are not really getting into it. Supermarkets went into it and some of them got burnt.
And that's the thing, they'll go, I'm not going to go near that again now until that part of the market looks really safe.
Yeah.
You know, Elon threw out that he was going to drop those prices overnight because he wanted to hit a quarterly target, right? It's as simple as that.
He's not a legacy.
No.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he doesn't care. He just wanted to hit a quarterly target and he'd done that, and obviously the backlash off the back of it. But I think we see some EV, used EV businesses, you know, doing quite well in the market now. And there's a lot, we've been and seen a lot of independent retailers over the last 12 months. The majority of them will say, I'm not going near one.
Yeah.
Not going to do it. Not going to go near one. Too much hassle. Is there an element of understanding of the product? They're scared of the pricing. Is it a mixture of things? You know, in 2023, and they're thinking 2030 is a while away. I'll just go with what I think what some of their attitudes have been.
It has been, but interestingly, when we look at average days to sell in the used market, EVs for cars are only 11 days longer than typical ICE vehicles, so that has to instill a little bit of confidence in
a retailer, definitely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we. You know, the early part of Q1 this year into Q2, you know, there was a significant level of caution. You know, there was a lot of people that bought, gone into it thinking, I'm going to have to do this, I'm going to get into EV. One, because, you know, there wasn't much else, you know. There was not a lot of product coming into the wholesale sector.
Yeah.
in general because of the shortage of registrations and the long lead times in terms of defleets and new car order banks. So there was a point in which actually, to keep my stock levels up and to keep my forecourt looking full and interesting, I've got to get into EVs. Mm. Now some of them, I would say, got burnt because they bought some of that product
price
drop of last year, Q1 of this year, and then they're seeing it drop. And at a certain time, and I think we're probably washing through it now, you had two halves. You had some of the, you had retailers that had old product and new product. They were trying to buy fresh product to wash out some of their old, mm-hmm. higher priced product. Now, we're starting to wash through that a little bit now. Mm. There's still a lot to be done. You know, there's still a lot around education, still a lot around consumer education and
massive.
Confidence in buying used battery electric vehicles.
Massive.
You know, there isn't the benefit in kind for the used car buyer like there is with the new fleet buyer or the company car user. You know, there's, we talk about two-tiered marketplaces. You know, the retail market in the new vehicle sector is still two-tiered because, you know, your benefit in kind, you opt out, you're great. They're okay because they get the tax benefit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your general new car buyer.
And there's not even an incentive at the minute, is there?
There's no incentive.
You know, there's no $2,000 off a new vehicle.
No, and you look at, I mean, Scotland, you get 0% finance on used battery electric vehicles. Mm. There's monetary incentives across some of the European markets.
Yeah.
You go over to the US and there is
there's mega discounts.
There's a tax. There's discounts through new.
Yeah.
But there's tax benefits to the used car buyer as well. So they get a certain tax benefit on buying a used battery electric vehicle up to $25,000. So there is incentives there.
That's trying to get people into this space of buying electric vehicles, isn't it? New or used. In the UK currently, there isn't really much of
that. There isn't. There isn't. And I suppose we've got to be careful because, you know, infrastructure is still a...
Major thing. Everyone always has a laugh when we do talk about that. And it is so true. It's so true. I do drive an electric, and at the minute, I only see it as if you drive electric right now in 2023, there is only one electric vehicle to go to because you've got a network that you can be pretty sure you can charge at anywhere around the country.
And a range to fulfill that.
And that is Tesla.
A reasonable range.
Yeah. And that is really it. You know, from a perspective
until
of...
Until you turn up and there's Vauxhall cars.
Yeah, I know. Charges. Until that point, yeah. you'll see fights on an electric charging forecourt. But still, so yeah, so interesting part. So we touched on it a little bit earlier, but let's go into a little bit. So obviously we speak to a lot of dealers, I'm sure you do. Feedback around from retailers, buying from auction, whether it's, well, mostly probably online, the accuracy of the gradings.
Yes.
What's that like? Because obviously there's always going to be noise, always. But, you know, has the grading changed? What's happening in that space?
I mean, everyone tends to, you know, as a sector, we abide by the NAMA grading.
Yes.
So all the appraisers go on regular NAMA grading courses. The equipment is to NAMA grading. And as a sector, you try to make sure that, you know, irrelevant of location, etc., you go through a step process through the NAMA grading appraisal app, and it measures the damage as seen by the appraiser. And it then grades it, whether it's a 2, 3, 4, or 1, whatever that is.
Yeah.
It's very subjective.
Absolutely.
Particularly by the buyers.
Yeah.
As to, you know, what
naturally.
Hey.
Yeah.
And it you know, being a retailer, being an independent dealer as well as franchise, you know, there's certain various standards that are very subjective as well. You know, I think continually there is looking for improvement on appraisal. You know, in some ways, you get feedback that's not a grade 3, it's a grade 2.
Yeah.
You've overgraded it. Or you get it that you've undergraded it, it's a grade 3, not a 2.
What's the outcome if that, you know, what's the outcome of that debate, if anything?
Then there's, you know, there's guarantees and the buyer indemnities and things like this that, you know, there's a pushback on it. and you put it right where you can. So that's what the guarantees are there for. I think, you know, you mentioned it, you muted it earlier in terms of AI. You know, there's AI technology out there, there's drive-through booths that, you know, is there in the marketplace. We are looking at it, other auction centres are looking at it. It's active in some auction markets in Europe and other marketplaces. I think, you know, people talk about AI and everyone gets all frightened and think of ChatGPT all the time when it comes to AI, whereas actually, you know, AI
it's an educational piece, isn't it?
It's education. That's just one off, yeah. You know, there is a, you know, where as a business, as a sector, AI has the opportunity to remove that appraiser subjectivity.
Mm.
You know, is that a scratch or is it a mark? Is it a dent? Is it a paint panel? Is it, you know, whatever that is. You use the AI to do that, but you also get this, you start to think about the efficiencies as well on the back of that. You know,
consistency
and efficiency, yeah. is the key behind it. So I think as a sector, we will see where AI gets used a lot more. And I think the main starting point for AI, in terms of other things, there's other things that AI can be used for in terms of efficiencies and productivity within the automotive sector. But I think the appraisal market is probably a key point where
so stand. So if you think about people going to a physical auction, looking around a vehicle before they buy it, how they would perceive, they would either go yeah or no, I'm going to bid on that, right? I can see it, I agree it's a grade two or what have you. Then you'll have someone sat at their office, earmarked that vehicle online.
Yeah.
It shows as a grade two or what have you online, they bid it, win it, gets delivered. They disagree with that. Do you see a lot of disagreement? Do you see more disagreement online? You must do, I suppose, right?
No, I don't think so.
Do you not?
No, I think there's I mean, in terms of online, you know, there's a lot of information in the online, you know, through imagery, video imagery, you know, you have the option, and if you think about years ago, there was this move towards video.
Mm.
You know, yeah. Auction centres, suddenly you were getting videos of the car.
Live feed. Mm. You're on the live feed or walk around.
We talk about walk around, full video. And live feed's always there anyway.
Yeah.
And you know, in terms of virtual space, that if somebody wants a close inspection or they want someone physically to walk around the car, then that does happen anyway.
Yeah.
But years ago, there was this whole thing about doing videos and not images. Whereas really, people, the sector pushed back on that and said, well, actually, we want a still image, because the still image allows us to zoom in and zoom out. The video doesn't allow us to do anything. The video's lovely.
Yeah.
It's pretty to watch, these 360 imagery, but actually, I don't want that. I want to be able to zoom in. I want to see the panel. I want to see the alloy edges. I want to see the leather trim. I want to see the edge of that seat wear and tear. I want to see the gear lever. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the online environment still do that, and they do it a lot. You know, they check the images, they've got the time to do that, they go through that a lot. And let's not forget, you know, where you've got this virtual and physical, you know, some of them probably know someone that's actually there at
that's
the sale.
That's the reality, yeah.
And there'll be a phone call, there'll be a message, and say, do me a favour, we're just going to have a look at that car and let me know if it's, you know, is that a dent or is it just the light or whatever. So, you know, I think, if you think about the auction as an intermediary, you know, they've got to do the best for the vendor. So the job is to get the best sale price for that vehicle. But also, they've got to do right by the buyer, because they want that buyer coming back and buying more vehicles, and want that buyer coming back and buying more vehicles off that vendor. So you've got to play both quite well.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not about, you know, doing good for the buyer and not doing well for the vendor, or doing well for the vendor and ripping off the buyer. That's not what it's about. It's about getting the best market value at that point in time in the market, supply and demand dynamics.
Yeah.
As possibly
and just on that, for come to mind there, around reserves, meeting of reserves, setting of reserves, what's the general setup around
depends
that?
Depends who you speak to.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, depend on
yeah.
who is... But what is it in the main that they
must
work
have been
towards?
Meeting reserves. For a while now, right? Surely.
Well, I mean, yeah, it depends on the vendor. I mean, you know, you have various different vendors. Those that are there just to achieve a percentage of cap clean,
yeah.
And those that actually understand the market, mm. and know whether it's strong or weak. You know, at the end of the day, you know, if it's 110, if that car is worth 110% of cap clean, then it's worth 110% of cap clean.
Yeah.
If it's worth 90% of cap clean, because that's the condition of the car and the appraisal of the car and the market and the spec, the condition, the history, the mileage, the colour, the ownership, etc., then yeah. that's what it is. And the vendors, you know, you'll get the vendors that know that, they know the market, and sometimes you'll have reserves that aren't necessarily anything to do with the on sale. And that's where, you know, we talk about early on about the physical versus virtual.
Yeah. You know,
the physical environment, you tend to, 9 times out of 10, you'll have the representative of the vendor there, whether that's Captive Finance or whoever they are.
Yeah.
They'll be on the rostrum with the auctioneers, reading the room, looking how strong it is, looking how weak it is. Sometimes probably really seeing that car for the first time properly in its full form. Yeah, because they'll see them in the compound and things like that. They'll know all the details.
Mm.
But actually, they'll stand there and they'll see that car come through into the auction hall.
They've set that.
They've got, you know, they've got a reserve, they've got what it owes them, what they might want to buy, what the reserve is.
Mm.
And actually, they'll be reading the room thinking, yeah, don't put it on sale yet, hold it, hold it, hold it. And then they'll give a nod to the auctioneer and say, right, put it on sale, because they'll know that actually they need to get the room moving.
Mm,
you know, yeah. And that might be well below the reserve, but it doesn't matter, because it's about getting the auction room moving on that vehicle. So that's where the physical help that.
Absolutely, because you've
got the auctioneer.
That's near on impossible to do online, right?
And the reading the room.
Yeah.
And making a decision. And that's where you'll see, if you've ever sat there in an auction hall, a physical auction hall, and you'll see a nod come from the vendor, or there'll be a conversation between the auctioneer and the vendor, and there'll be, you know what, you need to get this on sale or whatever. And then the auctioneer will go, on sale, which means start bidding, because you'll own it now. This isn't about meeting reserve. This is about being told that that car is now for sale.
Yeah.
So the bids will win. Yeah. So, because you get a point, and this is again auctioneers, and they're very, very good at what they do. You know, they start to work it then. Once they know that car's on sale, they'll start to bring the room, and they'll know whether to push the reserve, the bid up 200 quid, or whether to grab another 100 quid, or whatever that is, and they'll work it. And, you know, 50 quid's 50 quid, 100 quid's 100 quid, no matter what. And they'll be watching online, and the online will be going up as well. And, you know, don't forget, what people forget about this virtual versus physical, you know, your online buyers are listening to what's being said in the room. They're actually watching the activity.
Like a live feed normally, isn't it? Like a
live feed into it. So they, you know, away from a fully virtual, they start to feed off the room.
Yeah.
So if they're on a car and they're thinking, oh yeah, it's 10 grand and I'll hold there, and suddenly it's 10-1, 10-2, 10-3, and they can see hands going up all over the place and bidding numbers going up all the place, they think, actually, do you know what, I'm going to have a go at this. Whereas they may not have done.
Because they know the people physically think it's a good vehicle.
Yeah. Or they make a phone call and they'll find out from a friend that's physically there. And
yeah, is it worth paying a bit more on it?
Mm. Moving then into, I was talking about auction price there, but in terms of retail pricing in the live market, and be interested to get your thoughts, Philip, on how you see that going for the remainder of this calendar year in terms of retail pricing. What's your outlook view?
we were talking about this a little bit earlier, weren't we? You know, I think the market is toughening up. I think generally, I think at the minute, we're just coming out of that holiday period. We've had that period of sort of stagnant marketplace in the month of August. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of activity around holidays and things like this. You know, we've seen the Cap HPI book move at 3-year 60 down 2% from August into September in terms of the monthly movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, generally the market is now starting to soften. My view is that, you know, I think retail tends to lag a little bit behind trade. I think we're already seeing the weakness in trade. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing the first-time conversions just hover around the 80% mark, you know, sometimes a little bit over, sometimes a little bit less. Sales, depending on the type of vehicles and depending on the vendor, and depending whether it's a virtual or a hybrid sale, you know, just starting to soften a little bit as people are now thinking, you know, what's going to happen into September, October, November, into December now. You know, we're potentially talking about interest rate changes. It may not happen, but there's still a lot of economic pressure out there. Retail prices haven't really started to react yet. I think retail prices still seem to be holding fairly firm, but I think, you know, there's mutes that some of the dealer groups are starting to consider either buying bans or limitation on buying now, which is a little bit earlier than normal. You tend to get it back end of October into November.
Slow down, yeah.
But that slowdown, that sort of thinking, you know what, we've got to be a little bit careful. You know, we are getting a lot of new vehicle supply now, not by all manufacturers, but there are certain manufacturers that have got a lot of products on the ground. You can get immediate delivery, a lot of subvented 0% finance, a lot of deposit contributions, a lot of incentives now, a lot of marketing coming out of the OEMs for reg sales. So that will drive that new vehicle market. You know, the taps are back on in the world of Motability and the fleet sector. We've seen that for 3 or 4 months now in terms of the SMT registration numbers. Mm-hmm. So the market is starting to turn. So we're going to start to see, you know, those Motability cars come back into the dealer network or in through their systems. They'll start to see those leasing contracts start to come off as the fleet sector gets supply of vehicles. We'll start to see a increase in tactical registrations, pre-reg activity, pack deals starting to happen. The OEMs have got a, you know, they've got a target. September's a key month for them. You know, we've seen the increase in August of 24% in new car registrations from a very low base number. September will probably be about 385, something like that, 370, 385, which will be a probably a 40 to 50% increase on last year's performance. Still behind pre-pandemic figures, but a significant jump. OEMs are going towards this CAFE target, which they need to adhere to in the global registrations. We've got the ZEV mandate arriving next year. They've got to get some of these petrol diesels registered and into the marketplace. So there's all that starting to happen at a time where we already know used cars are coming back into the market, trickling in. You'll start to see a lot more of that into October, November. So I think, back to your question, Matthew, that I think we're probably going to see continue head of seasonal depreciation now for the remainder of the year. We've seen it for the last 5 months soften quite at first in terms of May. It started to increase through June, July, August. You know, we've seen ahead of probably 2.3% ahead of seasonal depreciation in sort of coming in September. That will probably continue through the remainder of the year. We'll probably see depreciation year at 3 years 60 at between 12% and 13.5%, which isn't excessive. But many will say, well, that's just standard annual depreciation on used cars. The problem is, on the back of 2 years worth of appreciation of significant strength.
It kind of links actually with my next question. So, and you touched on it a little bit before, some manufacturers are pushing out loads of new vehicles at the minute into the OEMs. Other manufacturers physically can't and haven't caught up. We know that some of the manufacturers are putting more effort into building their high spec vehicles versus their lesser spec, etc., because they want to have more money out of it. There's more margin in it. What's your view on new car prices and what they look like now versus, you know, pre-pandemic, and what do we think they're going to look like moving forward into next year?
In terms of new?
Yeah, new.
I mean, new car prices, you know, we saw it's slightly different in the UK than what we as a business observed over in the US, which I'll touch on slightly in a minute. But, you know, new car figures, new car prices tend to all always increase. You normally see 2 to 8% per year increase on average of new car figures through inflation. So it's a case of connection with inflation, new car figures. What we've got to be careful of is, you know, we're now getting the mixture of the EVs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just, you can't just say, okay, it's that Ford Fiesta, the Ford Focus, what was it worth last year, and except what was it new last year and year before that, because it's now changing the lineup of new car figures. I think, you know, EVs will start to, you'll get, to your point, Craig, that you'll get some of the OEMs focusing on the premium, the higher end, and you'll get some like the new entrants coming into the UK market that will focus on that lower end, you know, accessible price range, 20,000, 25,000, sub 20,000 for volume. But I think, you know, we start to see a bit of a stabilization probably on new. You know, the, you know, through 21, you couldn't really get any discount on a new car. You know, you had lead times going in 12, 18 months on some of those new cars as we came out of the pandemic. If you went over to the US, you'd be paying 150% of retail for a new car. You'd be bidding on a new car to buy one over in the US in mid-pandemic. But I think, you know, we'll see some stabilisation. I think the new vehicle market, the manufacturers have got some big strategic decisions to make globally. Where does the UK sit next year compared to what they do in Europe, what they do in some of the other international global markets? You know, because the UK, we've got the ZEB mandate, we've got potential tariffs coming into effect in terms of import, wheels of origin. There's a lot going on there. You know, you've got the recent announcement with Mini getting the investment to maintain in the UK market, the investment in Tata to invest in the UK market, which is all about rules of origin and productivity. But I think there's a lot to do before then, and strategic plays for the manufacturers, because as we talk today, the UK market is 5 years ahead of the 2030 deadline than our closest partner, Europe, which is 2035, and 10 years ahead of some other markets that are 2040. Now, as we move closer to the 2030 deadline, depending on where the manufacturer is in terms of their BEV targets and productivity, it will question where they place that product in the meantime. You know, do we put it into the UK market, or actually do we focus on Europe and get another 5 years out of this, or do we focus on another market that will give us 10 years out of it? So there's a lot to play out.
It's a good point, and that 2030 thing we'll come on to in a little bit. We'll finish on that one, I think.
Yeah, and one of the questions, we touched on AI earlier in the conversation, but it's a fascinating topic. You talked around some of the booths already in play in and around Europe in terms of that auction space. I guess, from your perspective, Philip, how do you think the automotive industry could benefit from the use of AI in the industry? I know we're talking, this is an auction special, but do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, you go over to China, there's probably, I've got Dubai, there's probably about 250 AI startups probably this year alone around in time. I mean, it's the big thing. I think, you know, there's a, from an AI perspective, I think we're only starting to really start to understand what AI is really capable of. And I think probably the negative side of this is what we saw about before with that chat GPT, is that, you know, I think people are worried about that because of capturing of data, capturing of information, reuse of information, because people are using it and just dropping, you know, Word documents into it and asking them to rewrite it and writing theses and all sorts of things. And it's just capturing all this intelligence. But actually look past all that and think, you know what, how do we use AI to manage our customer information better? How do we use AI to understand our buyer behaviours, our buyer activity, what people are doing online, how they're searching? You know, the AI is going to be key for that. You know, people are already talking about how they can use AI in terms of that online omni-channel space for inquiries, that you're not just getting a chat box response, you're getting a unique response specific to your question, that is, if you're talking to somebody, so if you're asking a question around the boot capacity on a Vauxhall Astra, it will talk to you about what you're wanting to use it for, and it'll understand then, you know, if you say, well, it's to put IKEA, will it fit an IKEA CADAX box in it?
Yeah.
Yeah. AI technology is good enough that it'll understand the book passed on the box or Astra. It'll also understand that you're talking about the CADAX IKEA box and what are the dimensions of it.
Yeah.
And it'll work it out and go, yes, you can use that and it will fit it in. It'll be that good.
Yeah.
So there's an element that it will work for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not going to be for everything. We already know that, you know, we talked earlier about that click and collect and the whole virtual and what we went through the pandemic and we know, you know, and online retail sales in the dealer world, and we talk about this in the wholesale world. You know, clearly in the short to medium term, there is a demand where the consumers still want an element of interaction. They want to, you know, they'll do a certain area of the process in the virtual space, and some of that will be managed by AI technology to give them the information, whether that's part exchange valuations or answer key questions or talking about finance, whatever that might be. But then there's an element where actually they want to talk to that. They want to talk to a person now. They want to go out of that. They want to come out of that process, go into...
A lot of data showing that people are reverting back to actually speaking to people in the buying process, right?
I think that there's an age demographic also within that, if I'm honest. You think of the millennials...
You're talking about us in this room.
Yeah, we're like a coffee and a chat with someone, right? Someone young just wants the deal done. But no, AI is a super interesting one. You're right, a lot of people just think chat GPT and what it does, whereas there's so much more that it can do for businesses from analytical data perspective, from a perspective of all the way to how cars are designed.
I don't think we've seen it yet. I think, you know, there's a lot more to come, and it's not about replacing people. It's about being more efficient, more effective, and giving service levels, you know, whether that's in the wholesale environment or whether that's in the retail environment, or just pure intelligence and insight around that. You know, it's got a place for it. I think it's just got to be, and we won't get into politics and things like this, but it's just got to be managed right.
I've listened to a lot of podcasts that talk about how it has got to be. It's got to be managed in the correct way before it goes too much, right?
But, you know, it's there already. You know, you look at, I mean, you'd mentioned Tesla before, and, you know, he's on about that driverless car, the autonomous vehicle. That can only be done through data.
They've just linked up with a new business, haven't they, for it?
Yeah, I think it's in his latest book, he's talking about it.
Yeah,
because it's got to, these systems have got to learn. They need data, they need to learn, and then they work on it. And it's not a process that we can do today.
I always remember it was a really old Top Gear. I'm sure it was a Top Gear. And it was Jeremy Clarkson who spoke, and he said if we're getting to a point where it's driverless, you know, it's driving for us. We're sat in that car, and there's a child or a pet on the road, that car has to make a decision on which one it saves and which one it hits.
Yeah.
You know, we are, that's what that system's got to do, in a position where there's an old person and a kid. Which one's it going to hit and which one's it going to miss? Yeah. How do you even, I cannot even fathom to think about how it's going to do that. And someone either gives, you know, these coders give it an opportunity to think for itself, and it can do the right.
I suppose it's
mind-blowing.
I suppose as a human, how would we make that decision? Would you be in a position to make? I mean, the first question is, would you even be in a position to be able to make that decision? Not have to make that decision, but actually be able to make that decision.
Yeah, have the option.
The autonomous vehicle, there's a step forward.
Already has predicted it.
Has an option to make that decision.
Yeah.
We as humans may not even have that option.
Yeah,
I think there's a, you know, autonomous was the buzzword pre-pandemic, as was mobility as a service, was, you know, you talk about podcasts and white papers. I mean, you know, there's so many of those in a pre-pandemic, that mobility as a service or autonomous, it's gone a little bit on the back burner. I think Tesla's the main one that's driving autonomous vehicles now, but is nowhere near. There's a lot.
I think a lot of people are probably scared of lawsuits.
Yeah, I'm going to get EV infrastructure right first.
Yeah,
don't
worry
about other things. We've got still 36 million vehicles on the road in the UK. Let's not worry too much about that yet.
So, last question of the day. We spoke earlier on a little bit about ULEZ expanding, blah, 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 the UK government, what are they doing, etc. 2030, the ban. Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I put a statement out. You may have...
you may or may not have heard that.
Yeah, I called it a curry vote, I think, at the time, where on the back of the by-election loss, wherever you look at it, win or loss, I suppose, depends how you take that, that suddenly the driver, the motorist, became the friend and the political friend of a potential election. Clearly we've got one, maybe two governments before 2030, possible. Can it change? And if it does change, does it make a difference? I'm not quite sure. Whether it's 2030 or 2035, if you listen to some of the noise coming out of the OEMs, Vauxhall are going to be...
Volkswagen were kicking off about a little while back.
Volkswagen kicking off with it. Volkswagen trying... I mean, you've got to remember from a VW and a VW group and a BMW perspective, you know, they're pushing heavily in Europe because they're trying to extend...
And the new e-fuels, right?
They're trying to get the e-fuels in place in Europe as part of the 2035, and they're trying to push the 2035 back 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a self... You know, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
You know? I think if the UK pushed it back 5 years, I think it would help. I think it wouldn't necessarily change the direction that we are heading, because Vauxhall have said they're going to be full EV by 2028.
Volvo
are already near enough full EV anyway. If not, they'll be full EV by 2025.
Peugeot 25.
There's this 2025 is this inflection point, and that's from an OEM perspective. Or even you talk to some of the fleet operators, they're talking 2025 to be 70% to 100% full EV.
Mm.
Now, if we go back a little bit and think about global production, think about productivity and efficiency, at the minute you've got OEMs trying to manage a production line that's making combustion engine and a production line that's making a bit of both with the plug-in, the hybrid market, and a production line that's trying to make full EV product. That is not efficient for the OEMs long term.
No.
Because, you know, in the, you've got, I think there's three off, there's a few engine block manufacturers. One of them is in Germany. That engine block manufacturer makes engine blocks for three manufacturers. They are close to going into administration because of the loss of volume.
Yeah.
Now, they require a 10 million cash injection, euros, from three manufacturers to survive and continue making combustion engines, to serve those manufacturers, for the manufacturers to make some combustion engine product.
Mm.
That is not efficient. So when we think about challenges around infrastructure, 2030 deadline, 2035 deadline, you've got to take it all the way up to manufacturing and plant level as to productivity and efficiency. You know, the quicker the manufacturer can say, do you know what, actually, I'm going to stick to combustion engine and hybrid, and I'm going to service South Africa and whatever marketplaces with that product, and I'm quite happy doing that. Or, actually, we still see the UK as a viable market for us, and therefore we need to transition to electric, and that's to service Europe and UK initially. They've got to turn that move fairly quickly, because it's about changing the productivity, changing the plants, and becoming more effective, more efficient, so that, to your point earlier about new car prices, productivity and efficiency start to drop prices.
Yeah.
You know, whilst we're playing around with some of these, some of that, some of the other, you actually run the risk of neither coming down. When you talk about price parity, you might get price parity between petrol and against ICE vehicles and EVs, but they might be both too high a level, because what would have happened, your EVs would have come down a little bit because of productivity, but your ICE vehicles would have gone up a little bit because of lack of productivity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they actually meet in the middle.
The prices, yeah.
But neither are cheap.
Mm.
Yeah.
And not until you switch to one or the other do you become cost effective.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the longer term benefit as well, of doing it? Because there's obviously millions of calculations out there saying, am I saving money by buying an electric vehicle and running it on a daily basis over a year versus an ICE vehicle? One thing you mentioned around the government, and there might be one or two different governments in place by that 2030 ban comes around. I can only imagine if there was a government that come in and said, actually, we're going to move it from 2030 to 2035, the sheer backlash that they may receive without, you know, they'll give all the excuses of saying we're not ready, the infrastructure's not ready, they could blame it on the previous government. Minefield on it, but you can only imagine what the
OEMs and everybody
we've done all this. You said it was 2030, it's a really, really interesting one. And anything else, Matt, you wanted to add to that?
No, I think that's quite a very insightful view that you've given, and we thank you for your time today, Philip, to get your views on the various
around
auction.
Philip, appreciate your views on it. We could chat it. More coffee, but no, really, really insightful. We do thank you for coming down today, and wish you all the best.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. Thank you.